Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Direct oral anticoagulants, or DOACs, have become a mainstay of therapy to prevent stroke and systemic embolism in patients with atrial fibrillation and venous thromboembolism. In 2016, the International Society of Thrombosis and Hemostasis recommended against the use of DOACs in the obese population because of pharmacokinetic concerns and limited outcomes data. The recommendation has challenged clinicians to determine if DOACs can safely be used in obese patients. Today, Dr. Joseph Zeminski, a cardiology pharmacist at Mayo Clinic, discusses the evidence of DOACs in obesity and answers the question, does one size really fit all?
So briefly, DOACs, or direct oral anticoagulants, are agents that are relatively new to the market. They've only come up really within the past 10 years. But despite being new to market, they've taken quite a hold within the anticoagulation community, with them now being first-line agents for both atrial fibrillation and venous thromboembolism. Now, with that being said, despite them being widely used in a great population, there are a couple populations that DOACs are not recommended for. One is patients with mitral valve stenosis, and a second noteworthy one is patients with mechanical valves. Now, there is a third population, the obese population, where in the past couple years, there's been concerns about whether or not DOACs are appropriate for use. And that's really the question I hope to answer in today's presentation, is are DOACs appropriate in the obese population? With that being said, there are three objectives for today's presentation. First is describe general pharmacokinetic changes observed in the obese population. Second is discuss pharmacokinetic changes and outcomes data specifically for DOACs in the obese population. And lastly is, given a patient case, select an appropriate DOAC for use in an obese patient. And to begin today's presentation, we really need to start by talking about obesity, which the CDC defines as a patient with a BMI of greater or equal to 30, and further subclassifies into three categories, class 1, class 2, and class 3, with class 3 being the most severe form of obesity, also known as morbid obesity, and these patients have a BMI of greater or equal to 40. And those are really the patients that we'll focus on in today's presentation. Now, with that being said, it should come to no surprise to anyone in the room that the national epidemic for obesity is real, with rates approaching 40% nationwide. Here in Minnesota and Olmsted County, it is slightly less at 30 and 27% respectively, but nonetheless, that means that about one in every four to one in every three patients that we see here at Mayo, in Rochester at least, are likely going to be obese. And it's important to understand that obesity is not a standalone disease state. These patients are hypercoagulable at baseline for two reasons. One, they're prothrombotic, meaning that they're more prone to forming a clot. And this is because when macrophages congest or consume adipose tissue, tissue factor is released. Now, we know that tissue factor is the start of the intrinsic clotting cascade. So these patients at baseline always have sort of a revved up intrinsic clotting cascade. Now, not only are these patients more prone to forming clots, but if they do form a clot, there's decreased fibrinolysis. And the reason for that is that adipose tissue intrinsically expresses plasminogen activator inhibitor 1, which is a potent antifibrinolytic. So obese patients at baseline are hypercoagulable. Now, pairing this with the fact that obesity is a risk factor for both atrial fibrillation and venous thromboembolism, which are two underlying hypercoagulable states, we can kind of see how these patients are at the perfect risk or the perfect storm for developing clots. So just speaking about atrial fibrillation and venous thromboembolism, thinking about AFib specifically, in these patient populations, the atria aren't contracting well. Therefore, we have static blood in the top chambers of the hearts. We know that static blood is formed to clotting, especially in the left atrial appendage. And if this blood does clot, you run the risk of the patient having a stroke after they embolize from the left atrium to the left ventricle, and that clot goes systemically. So we'll anticoagulate atrial fibrillation patients with the hope of preventing stroke. Now, likewise, for VTE, or venous thromboembolism, this includes both deep vein thrombosis and pulmonary embolism. We'll anticoagulate these patients to hopefully prevent recurrence. And until recently, specifically 2009, there was really only one agent on the market for patients with atrial fibrillation and VTE, and that agent was warfarin. However, in 2009, we had our first DOAC, dabigatran, come to market, and this was a direct thrombin inhibitor. Since that time, three other agents have come to market, rivaroxaban, apixaban, and edoxaban, and I had the landmark trials respectively for each agent listed on this slide. Briefly though, I think it is important to understand the outcomes of these trials so we can apply these findings and see how they may or may not differ in the obese population. So for the RELY trial from 2009, dabigatran when compared to warfarin, there was a decreased risk of stroke or systemic embolism without any increase in major bleeding. For rivaroxaban, compared to warfarin, there was no difference in stroke or systemic embolism or major bleeding compared to warfarin. For apixaban, there was both a decrease in stroke and systemic embolism and a major bleeding. And for edoxaban, there was a decrease in stroke and systemic embolism without any change in bleeding. And just within this past year, the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association, Heart Rhythm Society offered an update to their original 2014 guideline. And for the first time, we had guideline evidence to say that DOACs are recommended over warfarin in DOAC-eligible patients, at least in the atrial fibrillation population. And this was a class one recommendation, the strongest recommendation they could give. Now, in a similar time frame, looking at the VTE trials, so there were four other trials in the VTE population, RECOVER, Einstein, Amplify, and Hakusai VTE, and I have the respective agents listed on this slide. Very briefly, again, I just want to discuss the outcomes of these trials. So the primary efficacy outcome for all of these trials was recurrent VTE with a primary safety outcome of major bleeding. And for dabigatran, there was no increased risk of VTE, but a decreased risk in major bleeding for dabigatran when compared to warfarin. For rivaroxaban, there was no increased risk of VTE or major bleed for rivaroxaban compared to warfarin. For apixaban, there was no increased risk of VTE, but a major decrease in major bleeding. And for Hakusai VTE, there was no difference between VTE or major bleeding for edoxaban compared to warfarin. And with this information, in 2016, the Chest Society updated their VTE guidelines with a similar recommendation that DOACs are recommended over warfarin in DOAC-eligible patients. However, what's really important to acknowledge with all of these landmark trials is the amount of patients that were obese varied from trial to trial. And not only did it vary from trial to trial, but even their definition of obesity varied. So some trials used BMI cutoffs, while others used kilogram cutoffs. So even looking at the BMI cutoffs, though, from trial to trial, it varied from 35 to 36 to 30 kilograms per meter squared. So a heterogeneous definition of obesity. And again, really low percentages of patients were included in these trials were obese, anywhere at 10 to 40%. And what's concerning about this is DOACs are given as fixed doses or one size fits all doses to these patients based off their renal function. They're not monitored like warfarin. We don't get an INR or a level and necessarily respond in all cases for a DOAC. So we know that there are some pharmacokinetic parameters in the obese population that are different in the obese population. Therefore, there's the concern for potentially underdosing DOACs in these patients. So I'd like to spend the next couple minutes discussing some of these pharmacokinetic parameters, the first of which is volume of distribution. In its simplest terms, this is how much the drug distributes into the tissue. And the easiest way to think about volume of distribution is a two-compartment model, the central compartment, or the blood, or the peripheral compartment, which can be thought of as the tissue. And on this slide on the left, you can see the two-compartment model for a normal BMI patient, and a two-compartment model for an obese patient with an enlarged peripheral compartment, meaning more adipose tissue. So if a lipophilic agent is given to an obese patient, there's going to be relatively more drug in the peripheral compartment as compared to the central compartment, potentially leading to underexposure for these patients, predisposing them to treatment failure. The other parameter that I want to briefly discuss is renal clearance, or how much drug is removed via the kidney. So in obese patients, there's more drug removed via the kidneys, and this graph does a great representation of this concept. So we have weight on the x-axis with clearance in liters per hour on the y-axis. And you can tell that compared to a lower weight patient, higher weight patients have much more drug removed via the kidney in any certain period of time. So if you give a medication that's highly renally cleared to a patient that's, say, 200 kilograms as compared to a patient that's 80 kilograms, within the same amount of time, more drug is going to be removed in the 200 kilogram patient, respectively. And the thought with this is that obese patients have anatomically larger kidneys, and anatomically larger kidneys means more area for filtration. More filtration means more clearance, and therefore, again, you potentially run the risk of underexposing these patients if you use a highly renally cleared medication. So this leads us to our first poll everywhere question, just a reminder to respond via pollev.com/MayoRx, or you can text MayoRx to 22333 to join. And the question is, which of the following are true regarding volume of distribution and clearance in the obese population? All right, so it looks like many of the audience have likely responded at this point, with the majority selecting A, increased volume of distribution, increased clearance, and that is the correct answer. B, increased volume of distribution and decreased clearance would be incorrect because these patients have anatomically larger kidneys, therefore leading to increased clearance, not decreased. C would be incorrect because obese patients have larger peripheral volume of distribution, therefore increasing their volume of distribution, not decreasing. And D would be incorrect for the same two reasons as B and C. So let's look at the DOAC specifically now and see how their volume of distribution and renal clearance differ from one to another. So I have dabigatran, rivaroxaban, apixaban, and edoxaban listed on this slide and their respective volume of distributions and renal clearance. And relatively speaking, you can see that rivaroxaban has the smallest volume of distribution, followed by apixaban, then dabigatran, and then edoxaban. So in theory, edoxaban would distribute most into the peripheral compartment, therefore leading potentially to underdosing in an obese population. Applying the similar concept to the renal clearance data that we have, apixaban is the least renally cleared of the four DOACs, followed by edoxaban, then rivaroxaban, and dabigatran. So in theory, giving an obese patient dabigatran may lead to underdosing and potentially treatment failure, predisposing them to stroke or recurrent VTE, depending on what you're treating. But instead of just using theoretical data, let's look at actually some of the pharmacokinetic data that has come out for our four DOACs, dabigatran, apixaban, rivaroxaban, and edoxaban. And the first kind of sub-study that I want to talk about is from the RELY trial. And this was the trial that brought dabigatran to market for the atrial fibrillation population. And what the authors did is they looked at the high body weight population, which is defined as greater or equal to 100 kilograms, and compared that to the reference weight population, which was 50 to 99 kilograms. And you can see that the high body weight group had a mean trough that was 53% lower as compared to the reference weight group. And this makes sense based off what we discussed, right? Dabigatran is a highly renally cleared medication, therefore you run the risk of underexposing them. So that concept certainly holds true for dabigatran, but let's look at the other DOACs. For apixaban, a much smaller study, 36 patients overall, but a similar concept of a high body weight versus a normal reference, or excuse me, a reference weight group. You can see that for the mean peak and AUC, or area under the curve, which is a measure of total drug exposure, the high body weight group had relatively less as compared to the reference weight group, and the volume of distribution was increased by 24%. And taking this information as a whole, again, all of this would lead to potentially underexposure of apixaban in the obese population. For rivaroxaban, just a study of only 24 patients, but again, a similar setup with a high body weight in the reference weight group, there was no change in mean peak or AUC between rivaroxaban and the high body weight group or the reference weight group. And for edoxaban, unfortunately, we just don't have any pharmacokinetic data for how edoxaban performs or behaves in the obese population. So we really can't comment on how the parameters that we discussed necessarily actually play out in practice. And that leads us to our second poll everywhere question. And that is, which of the following DOACs does not appear to have a mean peak or AUC altered in the obese population? A, dabigatran, B, edoxaban, C, rivaroxaban, or D, apixaban? All right, so it looks like probably the majority of the audience has weighed in, and everyone chose C, rivaroxaban, which I agree is the correct answer. Dabigatran would be incorrect because we don't have any information for mean peak or AUC, but we do know that the trough is decreased by a substantial amount, about 50%. B, edoxaban, we don't have any information for how this medication, from a pharmacokinetic standpoint, behaves in the obese population. And D, apixaban, would be incorrect as we know that apixaban had both a lower mean peak and AUC in the obese population. So based on the pharmacokinetic data that we discussed, that yes, for at least for some of the DOACs, their pharmacokinetics are altered in the obese population, and pairing that with the fact that the number of obese patients in the landmark trials were relatively limited, in 2016, the International Society for Thrombosis and Hemostasis actually came up with a recommendation that they recommended that DOACs should not be used in the patients with a BMI of greater than 40 or a weight greater than 120, just because we don't know outcomes data for these patients. And I think at the time that wasn't a reasonable recommendation, but we do have some data since then that I'd like to discuss. Before we do that, though, just want to mention that they did offer a second recommendation, and that was that at the time, if you chose to use a DOAC in an obese patient, you can consider peak and trough monitoring. Now, there are some limitations with peak and trough monitoring. First is, depending on where you work, turnaround time may be lagged. Now, here at Mayo, we are fortunate enough to have relatively quick turnaround times, so that's not necessarily as much of an issue for us. But nationwide, there may be concerns about turnaround time for these assays. And second is all we have for DOACs are on-treatment ranges, not therapeutic ranges. So on-treatment meaning that in the clinical trials, we know that X, Y, or Z dose responded, or excuse me, displayed a mean trough between, you know, one level and a certain other level. And so we can't necessarily say how these correlated with clinical outcomes. We don't have data at this point. So I would argue they may not be the most useful in clinical practice, at least at this time. So I'd like to spend the rest of the presentation really going through some of the data that we have since 2016, specifically in this obese population. And I think it's important to break it down into the two disease states, atrial fibrillation and VTE, as really our goals with these patients are different. With the AFib population, we're looking to prevent stroke, whereas the VTE population, we're hoping to decrease recurrence. So starting with a meta-analysis from 2017, where data from the Aristotle, RELY, and ROCKET-AF trials, and I have the specific agents listed on this slide. But the authors looked at patients with a BMI of greater than 30 and looked at the rates of stroke or systemic embolism between DOACs and vitamin K antagonists. Now, worth noting that their BMI cutoff was 30, which is lower than the ISTH recommendation. But nonetheless, I think this data gets the conversation started of maybe these agents are reasonable. So briefly just going through, you can see that for Aristotle and RELY, the odds ratio point estimate was less than 1 with a 95% confidence interval crossing 1, signifying no difference between the DOACs or warfarin. For ROCKET-AF, the point estimate was just slightly over 1, but again, the 95% confidence interval encompassing 1. And taking these trials as a whole, again, point estimate less than 1, but the wide confidence interval encompasses 1, signifying no difference. Of note, you may notice that edoxaban is not on this trial, and it was just not included in the meta-analysis. So again, we're kind of left in the dark with how edoxaban performs, at least in a high weight or high BMI population. But not only is it important to look at efficacy outcomes for these patients, but it's important to look at safety outcomes as well. So the same meta-analysis looking at major bleeding for apixaban, dabigatran, and rivaroxaban, and similar findings, there was no difference between DOACs or vitamin K antagonists. But keep in mind, again, this was not the same population that ISTH was making the recommendation against in 2016. So since that time, we do have 4 small trials, some subgroup analyses, 1 claims data trial, and 2 single center trials for the DOACs. And the first one that I want to discuss is a subgroup analysis of the Aristotle trial. And keep in mind, this was apixaban versus warfarin in the atrial fibrillation population. And what they did is they looked at patients that weighed at least 120 kilograms, and this was about 1,000 patients, and they looked at the same primary outcomes as they did in the landmark trial, which was stroke and systemic embolism and major bleeding. And this was their findings. So on the x-axis, we have our 2 outcomes of interest, stroke and systemic embolism, as well as major bleeding. And on the y-axis, we have events per 100 patient years. Apixaban is represented by the blue bar with warfarin by the pink bar. And for both primary outcomes of efficacy and safety, there was no difference between apixaban and warfarin. Now, what I thought was really interesting in this subgroup analysis is not only did they stratify out high-weight patients, but they went one step further to look at patients that were 120 to 139 kilograms, as well as those who were greater than 140 kilograms. Looked at similar outcomes, so for stroke and systemic embolism, in the 100 to 139 kilogram group, there was a significant decrease with use of apixaban as compared to warfarin. And this was consistent with the landmark trial finding in the all-comers population. For major bleeding, however, there was no difference, which is a little bit different than the landmark trial in the all-comers population. For the patients that weighed more more than 140 kilograms, due to low event rates, they were not able to compare the two groups. And for all-cause bleeding, not necessarily major bleeding, but all-cause bleeding, there was no difference between the two groups. So from this data, I think we can at least start to say that apixaban appears superior to warfarin in stroke and systemic embolism prevention without an increase in bleeding up to 140 kilograms. So this is a little bit higher than the original ISTH recommendation. The second trial that I want to briefly discuss is claims data with rivaroxaban in the obese population. So just over 7,000 patients, half of which were on rivaroxaban, half of which were on warfarin, and all had ICD codes for atrial fibrillation and obesity. So these patients were propensity matched between the two agents, and again, they looked at ischemic and major bleeding outcomes. Again, our outcomes of interest are on the x-axis, with stroke and TIA on the left and major bleeding on the right, and percent event on the y-axis. And similar to our findings for the apixaban data, there was no difference between rivaroxaban, which is represented as the blue bar, and warfarin, which is represented by the pink bar, for these obese patients that were on either rivaroxaban or warfarin, respectively. And this was, again, keep in mind, a pretty large patient population of just over 7,000 patients. So from this information, we can start to conclude that rivaroxaban appears safe and efficacious for stroke and TIA prevention without an increased risk of bleeding in the obese population. And I want to round out the atrial fibrillation population data by speaking about two retrospective single-center studies, the first of which was a group out of South Dakota that looked at just over 120 patients, all of which had a BMI of greater than 40 or a weight greater than 120, and all of that which had AFib. Half of them were on DOACs, half were on warfarin, and then again, they looked at ischemic and bleeding outcomes. Looking at the baseline characteristics between the two groups, I think it's important to acknowledge the BMI was greater than 40, which was their patient population. Specifically, the mean came in at about 45, with a mean weight of about 140, with similar ischemic stroke risk between the two groups. And again, similar to all the setups we had so far, two outcomes of interest on the x-axis and percent per year outcome on the y-axis. DOAC represented by the blue bar with warfarin by the pink bar. And similar to everything we've seen so far, DOACs seem to appear efficacious and safe in the obese population. But a limitation had the authors just left it here was that they pooled all the DOACs together. And we know that based on the PK data, that may not be the safest and wisest thing to do. So they did break out each DOAC respectively. And in this graph, same setup as what we've seen previously, but dabigatran is represented by the dark blue bar, rivaroxaban by the pink bar, and apixaban by the light blue bar. I want to call your attention specifically to the stroke and TIA outcomes. And you can see that dabigatran was by far and away an outlier in this group, with upwards of 4% of patients that were on dabigatran experiencing a stroke or TIA. Now, it may be due to chance, it may be due to the PK data, but I start to get concerned based on this data that dabigatran may not be a great choice for obese patients that have atrial fibrillation. But nonetheless, again, apixaban and rivaroxaban do appear safe. And looking at the baseline characteristics in the DOAC group, I would say they're safe up to a weight of about 140 kilograms and a BMI of 45. And lastly, a little bit larger single center retrospective study out of a group from New York where they looked at patients with a BMI of greater than 40 and looked at apixaban, rivaroxaban, and warfarin. 103 patients on apixaban, 174 on rivaroxaban, and just over 150 on warfarin. Looked at stroke and bleeding outcomes. Average BMI in the DOAC group was again about 45, so consistent between all of the studies that we've looked at, and otherwise relatively well balanced between all of our variables between DOAC and warfarin. Again, we have stroke and major bleeding on the x-axis with percent events on the y-axis. The apixaban is represented by the dark blue bar, rivaroxaban by the pink bar, and warfarin by the light blue bar. And there was no difference in stroke or major bleeding between any of these three agents. So now we have our third or fourth, depending on how you're counting it, trial showing that apixaban and rivaroxaban appear safe and efficacious in BMI in patients with a BMI up to 45 in the AFib population. So I think there are a couple takeaways that we can make from these trials that I've discussed so far. First is rivaroxaban and apixaban appear safe, at least as safe and efficacious as warfarin in patients up to a BMI a 45 or a weight of 140 kilograms. And these are both a little bit higher than the original 2016 ISTH recommendation that was published. Now, from the KAIDO study, the group from South Dakota, my takeaway personally is that dabigatran should be avoided due to an increased risk or signal, at least, for stroke or TIA. And unfortunately, edoxaban, we really just don't have any data for how it performs from a clinical outcome standpoint or a PK standpoint in the obese population. Therefore, I think it should be avoided at this time. Now looking at the VTE data, or the venous thromboembolism data. Now as a disclaimer, there is a lot less data for VTE. The majority of our data is with the AFib population, but I want to just briefly discuss the VTE data. And the first is a meta-analysis similar to what we looked at for the atrial fibrillation group, but their primary outcome in the VTE trial was recurrent VTE, which makes sense. This was the primary outcome for all of the landmark trials. And for all of the trials that we looked at, there seemed to be no increased signal for recurrent VTE, but I do want to point off that the cutoff that they used to include patients in this meta-analysis was high weight, and that was how they defined it in the trial. So some used 90 kilograms, some used 100 kilograms, but 100 was the highest they went in the landmark trials for VTE. So again, doesn't necessarily match the ISTH recommendation. for major bleeding. For the most part, we saw similar outcomes. I think it's interesting that the Amplify trial, apixaban seemed to perform much better than vitamin K antagonist in the high weight group. And I don't necessarily know what to make of that, but just an interesting finding. But I think at least there's no signal for increased major bleeding or recurrent VTE based off this data. And really the only other data we have for DOAX in the obese population is that same retrospective study from New York, the single center study, where they looked at patients with a BMI of greater than 40, but this time they looked at patients that had VTE. Just shy of 370 patients, 47 were on apixaban, 152 on rivaroxaban, and about 170 on warfarin. The primary outcome that they looked at from an efficacy standpoint was VTE, and for their safety outcome was major bleeding. Again, the average BMI was similar between the two groups, about 45. And for both recurrent VTE and major bleeding, there seemed to be no difference between apixaban, rivaroxaban, and warfarin in this patient population that had a BMI of greater than 40. So I think from here, we can at least get the conversation started that DOAX may be appropriate, but I don't know that based off just this one single center study, I'm ready to full scale use DOAX in the obese population with VTE. So my takeaways from the VTE data are DOAX appear to perform well in the high weight patient groups from the clinical trials. But again, this is a lot smaller. It's at least 20 kilograms less than the ISTH recommendation. And in my opinion, due to limited outcomes data for DOAX in class 3 or these patients that have a BMI of greater than 40, in my opinion, DOAX should be avoided until at least more data is available. And this takes us to a patient case. So we have KL, a 55-year-old male with a BMI of 42 and a weight of 135 kilograms that presents to the ED complaining of palpitations, and the decision is made to admit KL after his ECG reveals atrial fibrillation with a heart rate of 118. Now, the service approaches you for a recommendation regarding oral anticoagulation as the CHADS VASC is 3, so this patient certainly does qualify for anticoagulation. And pertinent labs include a serum creatinine of 0.9 with a creatinine clearance of 80. Now, for the sake of this patient case, let's just say the patient is scared of needles, isn't willing to get an INR check, so we're limited to DOAX. So my question is, which of the following DOAX would be reasonable to initiate for KL? A, B, apixaban, C, rivaroxaban, or D, apixaban, D, edoxaban. So A, dabigatran, B, apixaban, C, rivaroxaban, D, edoxaban. The majority of the audience chose either B or C, and I think either of those are correct answers. We'll discuss them a little more in depth in just a second. Dabigatran, I agree, I would avoid in this patient due to the Kaido study that showed an increased signal for stroke or TIA in the obese population with atrial fibrillation. D, edoxaban, we really don't have any data for its use in atrial fibrillation in the obese population. Now, B or C, I could go with either answer. For B, I think it's reasonable. I think it's worth noting that if you're choosing it for its, in the landmark trial, what was perceived as the increased safety profile compared to warfarin for decreased bleeding, you may not have that necessarily preserved in the obese population. But based off the retrospective analysis of the Aristotle trial, I think that at least some of the efficacy in the obese population is preserved. And C, rivaroxaban, keeping in mind that the Rocket AF trial showed no increase in bleeding, no increase in stroke or TIA, and that's similar to what we saw within all of the data in the obese population. I think either B or C would be a fine choice for this patient. So overall takeaways for the presentation. So pharmacokinetic changes in the obese population include increased volume of distribution and increased renal clearance. Of the four DOACs, rivaroxaban appears least impacted by pharmacokinetic alterations in the obese population. And when looking at specifically the atrial fibrillation population, I think rivaroxaban or apixaban are reasonable choices, and my BMI cutoff would be in patients up to a BMI of 45. And in my opinion, DOAC should be avoided in the VTE population, the obese VTE population, until more data becomes available.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.